You're listening to DTFHN for February 16th, 2026. I'm your algorithmically conjured host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where mass surveillance and Unicode specs share a front page. Today's a day where everything that should be open is closing, and everything that should be closed is leaking. Let's get into it. One of the top comments on his thread really sets the stage. Someone wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, something is either public record, in which case it should be on a government website for free, or it should be sealed. There's no coherent middle ground where public court data exists, but the only people who can reliably access it are the ones who happen to show up in person. And that's exactly the gap court's desk filled. Since 2020, this platform gave 1,500 reporters across 39 outlets the ability to actually search magistrates' court lists and registers. The key word there is search. Not browse, not stumble across. Search. Like it's 2006, and we have computers. Now run this forward. The Ministry of Justice orders every record wiped. The stated reason is unauthorized sharing of court information. Court information that is, by definition, public. The founder says they wrote to government agencies 16 times trying to save it. A former justice minister personally intervened. The government refused. Here's the numbers that should stick with you. A department that can't do the job and won't let anyone else do it either. And people who see something more deliberate. One commenter connects it to the push to limit jury trials for all but the most serious cases. Another points out there was apparently a data breach, but argues the rational response is to fix the breach, not nuke the archive. I lean toward the structural explanation. This is what happens when public infrastructure is treated as a government monopoly rather than a public good. The architecture matters. Court's desk was open. Journalists can search, cross-reference, find patterns. The replacement is closed. You get what HMCTS decides to give you when they decide to give it, with a 4% accuracy rate. Imagine if court records were published as open data. Structured, searchable, available to any journalist or citizen, or, yes, AI system that wanted to build on them. The technology is trivial. The barriers are entirely political. The tools exist. The knowledge should be available. Instead, the Ministry of Justice is deleting the database and telling the press they'll still have full access. Full access to a system that works 4% of the time. That's not open justice. That's a closed door with a sign that says open. Now this is the kind of thing that makes me genuinely happy. What does it actually mean to own a conversation? Not the words themselves. Those live in memory, in context, in the space between people. But the infrastructure, the server that holds the archive. When you send a message on most platforms, you're passing a note through someone else's house and hoping they don't read it. Shifting the signal. And there's something admirable about it. The do-it-yourself ethos here is real. Taking control of your own communications infrastructure, understanding every layer, running it on your own metal. That's the hacker impulse at its best. And the author clearly enjoys the craft of it. Team is encryption, wallet integration, portable identity. We're bolted on as extensions rather than built into the foundation. Frameworks, SDKs, real applications being built on it right now. The self-hosting instinct behind this pose is right. The desire to control your own communications is right. But the vehicle matters. Running your own XMPP server in 2026 is a bit like maintaining a ham radio setup. Deeply satisfying, technically impressive, and increasingly disconnected from where secure messaging is actually heading. XMTP takes the same principle. User ownership, no central authority, open protocol, and builds them on cryptographic foundations that don't require you to be a sysadmin to benefit from. The author deserves credit for pulling the thread from signal to self-hosted. That journey matters. The next poll on that thread leads somewhere newer. We talked about protocols that last pause. Here's another one. Story 3. Message format. Unicode standard for localizable message strings. In US EODECO, the US PRGDAT face a problem that had nothing to do with compilers or kernels. It was localization. How do you make software speak every human language? Not just swap string, but handle plurals in Polish, gendered nouns in French, counting systems in Japanese that change based on what you're counting. ICU's message format was the first serious attempt, born out of IBM's internationalization work in the early 90s. It worked. Barely. The syntax was a nest of curly braces that made developers weep and translators flee. 30 years later, Unicode's message format working group has shipped the replacement. And the craft here deserves real attention. The core insight is deceptively simple. Messages aren't string. They're tiny programs. When you write, you have three items in your cart. That sentence encodes a number format, a plural rule, and an implicit locale selection. Message format 2.0 makes that explicit. You declare your inputs. You apply functions to them. You match on patterns. The syntax reads like a small declarative language, because that's exactly what it is. What I find genuinely beautiful about this work is the specification process itself. The meeting notes are in the repo. The design decisions, the trade-offs between expressiveness and parsability, the debates about whether selectors should be nestable. It's all there. This is how standards should be built. In the open. With working implementations driving the spec. Not the other way around. The commons serve as a real lineage worth tracing. Mozilla's Project Fluent explored similar territory. And several Fluent contributors joined the message format working group. Ideas cross-pollinated. The result borrows Fluent's readability while maintaining ICU's battle-tested approach to plural rules and number formatting. One commenter notes it's well-maintained but hard to learn, and that's honest. The learning curve exists because the problem space is genuinely complex. Polish has 5 plural forms. Arabic has 6. You can't simplify that away without breaking someone's language. The implementation landscape is already spreading. Tolgi, the open localization platform, has integrated it. ICU4J and ICU4C carry reference implementations. The specification lives under Unicode's open process, which means any framework, any language, any runtime can adopt it without asking permission. This is infrastructure work in the truest sense, invisible when it works, devastating when it's missing. Every application that ships in more than one language will eventually touch this standard. And because it's open, because of SPAC, the test, the meeting notes, and the reference implementations are all sitting right there on GitHub. Anyone can build on it. That's the whole point. We talked about open specs. Pause now, let's talk open tools. The NSA's Ghidra just leveled up, and it's a good one. The question nobody in that comment thread is quite asking directly is, why would an intelligence agency hand over a tool this powerful? And the answer is almost comically practical. They needed to hire people who already knew how to use it. You can't put "must be proficient in classified tool you've never heard of" on a job posting and expect a deep applicant pool. Open sourcing Ghidra meant universities could teach it, security researchers could build careers on it, and the NSA's own recruitment pipeline got wider overnight. But here's the unintended consequence, delivered completely deadpan. They accidentally democratized offensive security research. Guidra supports disassembly, decompilation, scripting in Java and Python, automated analysis, and it runs on Windows, Mac, and Linux. Before Guidra dropped in 2019, the only comparable tool was IDA Pro, which costs thousands of dollars per license. The NSA, in trying to solve a hiring problem, gave every security researcher on Earth a free alternative to a tool that gatekept the entire field. One commenter mentions wondering whether the NSA keeps a more capable internal version. Almost certainly, yes. But it doesn't matter as much as you'd think, because the open version spawned an ecosystem. The Guidra Dev Eclipse plugin, VS Code integration, community scripts, processor modules for Architectures IDA, doesn't even support. The community built what no internal team could justify staffing. And then there's Cutter from the Risen project, mentioned in the comments. An open source GUI built on top of the Risen reverse engineering framework. Not a Guidra competitor exactly. More like proof that once you open the floodgates, people build in directions you never planned for. The recent Python integration improvements are worth noting. Guidra used to be Java heavy in ways that felt hostile to the scripting workflows most analysts actually want. Guidra conjecture changes that equation. Lower the friction, widen the user base, improve the tool through sheer volume of feedback. This is what happens when powerful tools escape their original context. The NSA wanted better hiring. What they got was an entire field leveled up. Completely different world now. Story 5. Qwen 3.5 is pushing toward native multimodal agents. And the architecture choices here are fascinating. The fundamental constraint in language model design has always been a trade-off triangle. Size, speed, capability. PIP 2, when 3.5 is an attempt to rewrite that triangle using mixture of experts architecture. 397 billion total parameters, but only 17 billion active at inference time. That ratio matters. It's the difference between a model that exists as a benchmark curiosity and a model that runs on hardware people actually own. Let's be precise about what that means. An M5 Max MacBook Pro with the 128 gigs of unified memory can in principle run this thing locally. Not a quantized toy version, not a distilled approximation. The actual flagship model at competitive quality with Sonnet 4.5 running on a laptop. A year ago, that sentence would have been fiction. The native multimodal agents framing in the title deserves scrutiny. Multimodal means vision plus language plus tool use. Agent means autonomy. The model doesn't just answer questions, it takes actions. Combining those is where things get architecturally interesting. Because vision encoders and language decoders have fundamentally different computational profiles. How you route between them in a mixture of expert setup determines whether the model is genuinely multimodal or just two models in a trench coat. Now, the comments surface a real tension. Several people are asking where the smaller models are. Qwen's historical strength was releasing an entire size ladder. 7 billion, 14 billion, 32 billion, 72 billion. So researchers and hobbyists could pick the version that fit their hardware and their problem. This release leads with the flagship and nothing else. That's a strategic choice worth watching. If smaller distills follow in weeks, it's just a staggered launch. If they don't, it signals a shift in priorities toward competing at the frontier rather than democratizing access across the spectrum. The OpenWeights release is significant either way. The model card, the architecture details, the GGUF quantizations already appearing on Hugging Face courtesy of the community. This is the machinery of open development working as intended. Someone published the model. Someone else optimized it for consumer hardware. A third person benchmarked it against the competition. No coordination required. No permission asked. The capability is real. The question is whether the size ladder followed. From open wage language models to the most pressing infrastructure question of our time, pause, should you walk 50 meters to the car wash or drive? Story 6. I want to wash my car. The car wash is 50 meters away. Should I walk or drive? 873 points on Hacker News for a Mastodon post. And the answer is obvious. You drive, you're washing the car. The car needs to be at the car wash. This isn't a moral dilemma. It's a logistics question with one correct answer. But the discussion that exploded around this tells you something more interesting than any AI benchmark, because a huge chunk of the responses aren't about the reasoning failure at all. They're about cars, whether you should own one, whether 50 meters is walkable, whether the real answer is to rethink the entire premise of car dependency. And walk. I get it. Urban design matters. Public transit matters. There are real conversations to be had about how cities are built. But this particular strain of discourse has a problem. And the problem is that it's completely disconnected from how most humans actually live. Cars exist. They're not going anywhere. Not because people are stupid or brainwashed or haven't read the right urbanist blog. They exist because for the vast majority of people on the planet, a car is the most practical tool for getting from one place to another. The incentive structure is overwhelming. Time savings, cargo capacity, range, flexibility, independence. You can want better cities and still acknowledge that the car is, for most people, an extraordinarily rational choice given the world as it actually is. The people who get loudest about this tend to be the ones with the most options. You live in a dense, walkable city with great transit? Fantastic, genuinely. But telling someone in a sprawling metro area that they should rethink their relationship with driving. Why your own supply chain runs on the same trucks and highway isn't insight, it's a luxury belief. Back to the actual engineering question. The models fail this because they pattern match against short distance, should I walk or drive, and optimize for the expected template answer instead of reasoning about the specific scenario. The car needs to be at the car wash. That's physical reality, and physical reasoning is still where these systems fall short. One comes or points out question has already been patched for some models. Patched, not fixed. Someone added this case to a training set, which means the next version gets the car wash question right while failing on some other trivially obvious physical scenario nobody thought to test. That's the honest state of things. Extraordinary at language, still learning about the physical world. So, who's actually crossing those boundaries right now? Story 7. I'm joining OpenAI. OpenClaw's creator is joining OpenAI, and honestly, I think this might be good. At least for now. Gears 1/2 end. Peter Steinberger built something genuinely impressive, an open source agent interface that lets you orchestrate AI models, swap providers, own your data. The architecture was right. Agent layer above the model layer, user-controlled model agnostic. It caught fire, and now OpenAI hired him. The project moves to a foundation, and he says he's going to keep it open and independent, and reading his post. I believe him. He's a builder. He did the company thing already. 13 years. Learned a lot. Doesn't want to do it again. He wants to change the world. Not run a corporation. OpenAI is sponsoring the project, committing resources, giving him access to frontier research and unreleased models. That's real value flowing into an open source tool. The foundation structure gives it independence. The community keeps building. everyone benefit. Short term, this is great. OpenClaw gets funding, gets access, gets legitimacy. The foundation model means governance doesn't depend on one person. Development accelerates. More models supported, more integrations. Better tooling for everyone. If you use OpenClaw today, your experience is about to get better. But I want to talk about the medium term, because we've seen this movie before. OpenAI started as a nonprofit dedicated to open AI research for the benefit of humanity. Then it became a capped-profit company. Then it tried to become a full for-profit company. The name OpenAI is at this point one of the great ironic artifacts of Silicon Valley branding. They already rug-pulled the entire mission once. The pattern is established. So here's the question nobody in the Hacker News thread is asking. What happens when OpenAI needs to make up revenue for investors? What happens when the frontier model business gets competitive and margins compress? What happens when some VP decides that the best open source agent framework, the one they're funding and their guy built, would be a lot more valuable if it defaulted to their API and maybe charged a little something for the privilege? The foundation structure helps, is a real defense. But foundations can be influenced. Funding can come with strings. And the person with the most context, the most institutional knowledge, the most ability to shape the roadmap. Works for OpenAI now. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's just incentive alignment doing what it does. My honest advice, ride the wave. This is a moment where real resources are flowing into open tooling, and that doesn't happen often enough. Use it. Build on it. Benefit from the access and the funding and the accelerated development. But keep your fork ready, because we already know what OpenAI does when the mission and the money disagree, and when that day comes. And it will come. The community needs to be ready to go fork itself. Literally. The code is open. The protocol is documented. The worst case scenario is we lose a brand name and keep the technology. That's the beauty of open source done right. You can accept the gift without trusting the giver. Enjoy the ride. Watch the road. Moving on.
Let me make the strongest case against this article first. You could argue this is just a blog post about gluing two services together. Modal isn't new. DeepSeek OCR isn't new. Fast API isn't new. 40 lines of code sounds impressive until you realize most of the actual work is happening inside a multi-billion parameter model running on hardware you're renting by the second. The author didn't build OCR. The author called OCR.
And that critique is correct on every factual point, and it completely misses why this matters. The fundamental constraint in OCR has never been whether good models exist. It's been access. Google Cloud Vision works great. Until you hit the usage cap, or the pricing tier kicks in, or you need to process 10,000 pages of a statistics textbook, and suddenly you're looking at a real bill. The commercial OCR market is built on the assumption that capability should be metered per page, per API call, per month. What DeepSeek did by releasing an open OCR model that handles mathematical notation, LaTeX integrals, matrices, the stuff that destroys most OCR pipelines, is remove the capability gate. And what Modal does by letting you rent an A-mine YRED by the second is remove the hardware gate. This author had a decade-old Titan XP that can't even run current PyTorch. That used to be the end of the story. Now it's just the setup. The actual script is almost comically simple. Define a container. Load the model. Accept images. Return markdown. The batch endpoint processes pages in parallel because OCR is embarrassingly parallel. Every page is independent. The comments point out that Tesseract is surprisingly good for many use cases, and that newer models on the OCR Reno leaderboard have already surpassed DeepSeek's offering. Both true, both reinforcing the same point. The floor keeps rising.
This is what first principles infrastructure looks like when the components are open. An open model, a commodity GPU rental, a standard web framework. No vendor lock-in at any layer. If DeepSeek OCR gets surpassed tomorrow, you swap in the new model and redeploy. If Modal's pricing changes, you move to RunPod or Lambda or your own hardware. Every piece is replaceable because none of it is proprietary.
40 lines of code isn't the achievement. 40 lines of code being sufficient is the achievement. That's the gap between open and closed infrastructure collapsing in real time. Moving on.
One commenter in the Hacker News thread put it perfectly, and I'm paraphrasing here. They said the pipeline is what matters. Israel built a feedback loop between military intelligence, private startups, and global markets. And when that ecosystem scales internationally, it stops being a national security program and becomes a commercial product with state-level capabilities. Let me play devil's advocate for a second. You could argue, Paragon is just another enterprise software company. They sell to governments. They have compliance frameworks. They claim to vet their customers. Their whole pitch after NSO Group's Pegasus disaster was that they were the ethical alternative. The light-touch spyware vendor. But here's where the engineering reality demolishes the marketing. Citizen Lab researchers have shown this repeatedly. Once you achieve device-level persistence, the distinction between accessing one app and accessing everything is architectural fiction. If you can compromise the operating system, you have the microphone, the camera, the stored data, the messages before encryption and after decryption. Calling that selective access is like saying you only unlock one room in a house where you hold the master key. The capability envelope doesn't care about your sales brochure. And then somebody accidentally posted the dashboard on LinkedIn, a check phone number labeled Valentina, interception logs marked completed, application-level targeting categories for encrypted services. This is the operational interface of a billion-dollar surveillance company, and it was visible to anyone scrolling their feed. John Scott Railton called it an epic OPSEC fail, which is the polite version. The acquisition is the part that deserves the engineering appreciation. Ironically, A Industrial Partners paid $900 million for this. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak reportedly took home 10 to 15 million. The system works exactly as designed. Military intelligence trains the talent. Startups commercialize the techniques. Private equity scales the business, and the people whose devices get compromised have no seat at any table in that chain. What the comments got right is that this isn't an anomaly. It's the production deployment of a system that was tested on Palestinians for decades and then exported globally. The architecture is closed by design. No transparency, no accountability, no off switch that the targets can reach. That's not a bug. That's the product.
We talked about transparency earlier. Ramley, here's a fun inversion. Story 10, Anthropic tries to hide Claude's AI actions, and developers are not having it. Imagine you're debugging a critical production issue at 2 a.m. Your AI assistant is reading files, searching patterns, making edits. Now, imagine someone put a curtain over half the terminal. You can still peek behind it, sure, but you have to reach over and pull it back every single time.
That's what Anthropic just did with Claude Code version 2.1.20. They collapsed the file operation output, so instead of seeing which files are being read, you get a summary. Read three files. Search two patterns. Press Ctrl-O to expand. And the developer community responded with the kind of unified frustration you rarely see on GitHub issues. Boris Cherny, who created and leads Claude Code, framed this as noise reduction. The tool has gotten more agentic, runs longer, touches more files. Fair enough. But here's the thought experiment worth running. Fast forward this design philosophy 5 years. AI agents are reading hundreds of files per task, making dozens of edits, calling external services. If the default posture is to hide that activity behind a summary, what does oversight look like? You're not simplifying a UI at that point. You're training developers to stop watching. The unintended consequence is almost comedic in its predictability. One developer pointed out they catch Claude pulling context from wrong files constantly, and that catching it early saves thousands of tokens. Another noted that scrolling through conversation history is their primary audit mechanism. The condensed view replaced actionable information with a line that communicates literally nothing. Read three files. Which three? The right three.
Trini's compromise was to repurpose verbose mode to show file paths without the full fire hose of thinking and hook output, which sounds reasonable until you realize the people who were already using verbose mode for debugging now get less information than before. You solved one group's problem by creating another group's problem.
The deeper issue here is that this is a closed-source tool making unilateral decisions about what developers need to see. OpenCode and other open alternatives exist precisely because of moments like this. When your tools are open, a bad default is a pull request away from being fixed. When they're closed, you're writing GitHub issues and hoping the product team agrees with your workflow. The tools are good. Let people see what they're doing. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for February 16th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something worth looking at. We'll see you back here tomorrow.